Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present Phyllis Bennis of the Institute for Policy Studies, who explains why she believes the results of recent Israeli elections provide little hope for the renewal of long-stalled Israeli-Palestinian peace talks. A report on a Portland, Maine protest opposing plans to pump tar sands oil from Canada to New England, the largest anti-tar sands action in the Northeast to date. And Alexis Tsipras, leader of Syriza, the coalition of the radical left, Greece's main opposition party, who talks about anti-austerity politics in Greece, Europe, and beyond. But first we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
A new slickly produced video surfaced in the Middle East showing Iraqi and Lebanese Shiite fighters defending the embattled regime of Syrian President Bashar al-Assad in the suburbs of Damascus. The fighters include veteran gunmen from Lebanon's Hezbollah Shiite militia, which is allied with Syria and Iran. The conflict inside Syria, which has cost the lives of over 60,000 people, is increasingly seen across the Middle East as a conflict between Sunni and Shiite Muslims rather than simply a bloody conflict to oust a brutal regime. Shiite groups worry about being the next target for Sunni jihadists who see all Shiites as heretics. Syria, under the Assad family, has become the linchpin of the Shiite arc in the Middle East, linking the nation with Iran and Hezbollah in Lebanon. Assad's fall could diminish Iran's influence and put more power in the hands of Sunni nations like Saudi Arabia and Turkey. As a consequence, Hezbollah could become isolated and vulnerable to attacks from Sunni jihadist fighters. Some Sunni groups in Lebanon are now openly backing the armed opposition in Syria. In recent months, several hundred Lebanese have volunteered to fight alongside the Free Syrian Army. In mid-January, gun control advocates and opponents came face-to-face on the streets of Dallas, Texas. On one side of a downtown street, the First Presbyterian Church was running a gun buyback program offering cash for guns, which would be destroyed. Across the street, gun rights activists organized a gathering to resell firearms undertaken as a protest against the church's gun buyback program. The dueling gun exchanges emerged as Second Amendment supporters mobilized to protest the push for gun control, which includes proposals for renewing the ban on assault weapons in the wake of the murder of 20 first-grade students and 6 educators at the Sandy Hook Elementary School in Newtown, Connecticut. There was a long line outside the First Presbyterian Church, which has a long history of organizing gun buyback programs. However, this was the first time gun rights activists objected. Overall, the church collected 109 guns, including 2 garbage cans full of rifles, which were later destroyed. The crisis over homelessness is over 30 years old with no solution in sight. A recent survey by the U.S. Conference of Mayors found most major cities have witnessed a surge in homelessness, with homeless parents and their children increasingly being turned away from shelters. At the same time, cities are clamping down on the homeless, banning sleeping or lying down in public places. Advocates for the poor are working on developing new approaches to assist the homeless. Rhode Island became the first state last summer to pass a homeless bill of rights law, which banned bias against the homeless in the use of public parks, transportation, and buildings. In California, advocates are pushing for a Homeless Persons Bill of Rights and Fairness Act, sponsored by San Francisco Assemblyman Tom Amiano. Specifically, the bill calls for protecting the homeless in life-sustaining activities on public property. In a survey, Paul Bowden, a co-founder of the San Francisco Coalition on the Homeless, found homeless persons are increasingly fearful of harassment and arrest for sleeping, loitering, or sitting on the sidewalk. The 30-year homeless advocate compares the recent crackdown to the ugly laws from the late 1800s, which barred disabled people from public spaces. It was not until 1970 that Chicago repealed the last ugly law. Bowden told Alternet, "This reactionary approach by local governments criminalizing the presence of a specific subset of the community has a long history in this country. It has different names, but every 30 to 40 years we seem to go through this cycle." This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Liz Becker.
Israel's January 22nd election was predicted to safely reinstall Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu's Likud party in coalition with Avigdor Lieberman's Yisrael Beiteinu party for another term in office. While opinion polls had projected that the ruling conservative coalition would win between 32 and 45 seats in the Israeli Knesset or parliament, when the votes were counted, they had won only 31. Two new parties emerged as beneficiaries from the erosion of public support for Netanyahu. Journalist-turned-politician Yair Lapid led his new centrist Yesh Atid, or There Is a Future party, to win 19 seats, in second place behind Netanyahu's coalition. Lapid's candidacy capitalized on growing resentment of government subsidies given to ultra-Orthodox Jews and Netanyahu's inaction on conforming to a Supreme Court order that mandates an end to military draft deferments for Orthodox men when they turn 18. While much of the world has focused concern on recent Israeli bombing attacks and incursions into the Hamas-controlled Gaza Strip and Netanyahu's expansion of Jewish settlements on Palestinian land, the issues of conflict and future peace talks with the Palestinians was hardly visible in the Israeli election campaign. Your reporter spoke with Phyllis Menes, director of the New Internationalism Project at the Institute for Policy Studies. Here she explains why she believes the results of the recent Israeli election provide little hope for the renewal of long-stalled Israeli-Palestinian peace talks.
Well, I think the best way to sort of see what happened with the Israeli elections would be to understand it as a victory for the status quo for Israel. This is a defeat for Bibi Netanyahu. He will continue to be the prime minister, almost certainly, but with far less political clout than he had going into this election. It was anticipated that his party, in its alliance with an even further right party, it's a two-party alliance, that they would come out with something like 42, 43 seats. In fact, they ended up with only 31, which is a significant decline. The other sort of surprise was the rise of this so-called centrist party, as you say, the Yesh Atid. What's interesting about that, Scott, is that how the discourse shifts in this country. We talk about it as a centrist party, that it was a center-left bloc, that the Israeli Knesset is now divided between the center-right and the center-left, when in fact the so-called center-left, or this centrist party in particular, which is a brand new party led by a TV news anchor, they came out with 19 seats, the second biggest bloc in the whole Knesset. But their whole basis of existence was framed around issues of sort of social equality within the Israeli Jewish community only. So their big issue was a set of kind of what were considered sort of middle class issues around prices and that sort of thing. And most importantly, the question of sharing the burden of the military in a more equitable way, specifically the call to include in the otherwise universal draft of Israeli Jews, the ultra-Orthodox, who since the founding of the State of Israel have been exempt from the draft on the theory that they would protect the nation by spending their lives studying the Torah. And there finally started to be a kind of pushback against that by secular Jews, who are obviously a major component within the Jewish community in Israel, who said, that's not fair, we're taking all the risks, they sit around studying all day, that's not fair. So the big question now is limited to this question of, well, what's going to happen with the new coalition? Will Bibi Netanyahu's coalition of his party and the ultra-right party of his former foreign minister, Avigdor Lieberman, the Israel is my home party it's called, will that party, which includes in it a lot of ultra-Orthodox forces, will they be able to form a grand coalition with this new centrist party that is so much, in their view, opposed to the ultra-Orthodox by daring to suggest that they should play their part in the military. Now, the irony of all of this, Scott, is that none of this signals any change in the far-right position of the Israeli government that's been true for so long through Labor governments and Likud governments and coalition governments of oppression of the Palestinians, settlement expansion, the siege of Gaza, none of that was on the agenda. The differences they may have, none of that played out in the election.
Phyllis,
When you look at President Obama's second term in office, is there any indication that his administration will pursue more aggressively in the next 4 years what they didn't in the first 4 years, and that is to push Israel and Bibi Netanyahu to not be as much an obstacle towards renewing peace talks?
I mean, certainly this is a situation where the president could dramatically change his posture vis-a-vis Israel, could dramatically move to take seriously what President Obama was accused of doing falsely back in 2010. You remember in that second year of his first administration, when that summer there was, you know, a great heightened tension between Netanyahu and Obama, and there was all this talk and lots of press about, oh my God, this is getting very bad. Obama is turning out to be anti-Israel. Obama is pressuring Israel. Obama is throwing Israel under the bus. Well, in fact, there was no bus. In fact, there was no pressure. There were a series of requests, which were rather unusual. It didn't happen too often, that a U.S. president requested of the Israeli prime minister, please stop expanding illegal settlements. The answer from the Israelis, no. The request was repeated, please stop building settlements. No. And then the request stopped. That was the end of that. Real pressure would have looked very different. Real pressure would have looked like a demand from the Obama administration, stop building settlements, they're illegal. The Israelis say, no. And the answer is immediately, okay, you're an independent country, you can do what you want, but you know that $30 billion of our U.S. tax money that we have pledged to give directly to your military over these 10 years? You can kiss that goodbye. And you know how we've been protecting you in the United Nations? So that no Israeli military or political official is ever held accountable for violations of international law and potential war crimes, we're not doing that anymore. That's what pressure looks like. And we didn't see any of that.
That was Phyllis Spennis, director of the New Internationalism Project at the Institute for Policy Studies. Find more news and analysis on the Israeli election and the Palestinian nonviolent resistance movement on our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. The Portland Pipeline Corporation says it has no plans to reverse the flow of an oil pipeline to transport Canadian tar sands oil to Portland, Maine's harbor for export. But despite the company's public denial, about 1,000 Maine residents, joined by activists from all over New England and Canada, rallied on Saturday, January 26th at Portland Harbor to put their concerns about that very possibility on the map. The action was supported by local and national environmental groups, including 350.org, the Sierra Club, the Natural Resources Defense Council, Environment Maine, and the Natural Resource Council of Maine. There's growing opposition to the extraction of tar sands oil because it produces far more greenhouse gases that contribute to global warming than conventional production methods. Enbridge, the Canadian company responsible for spilling almost 1 million gallons of tar sands oil in the Kalamazoo River in Michigan in 2010, has applied for a permit from the Canadian National Energy Board to reverse the flow of its Line 9 pipeline from Midwest U.S. states to Montreal, declaring it might transport heavy crude oil. Environmentalists fear that the pipeline will eventually bring tar sands from the province of Alberta in the west to eastern Canada, where it could connect with an existing pipeline that runs from Montreal to Portland. That 236-mile-long pipeline already has a presidential permit allowing it to cross an international border, but the permit makes no mention of tar sands. Between the Lines' Melinda Tuhus was in Portland during the January 26 march and rally and files this report featuring some of the voices of protest activists. We first hear from Portlander Jason Wentworth, who came to the rally with his daughter by bike.
We don't want your dirty oil. Leave the tar sands in the soil.
We don't want your dirty oil.
We just took a tube that's about 8 inches in diameter and made up a little sign on it that says no tar sands and mounted it on her bike stroller. And it was actually her idea to do something like a pipe. And she was quite excited about riding in it. The cold has taken away a little bit of her excitement, but she's still into it. I'm here to be with the rest of the people who are here in support of a petroleum-free future, if you will. And the tar sands are a particular concern here in Maine because we've got a pipeline that ExxonMobil wants to use to bring them through to our port. And that pipeline is way too old to handle this kind of material. And if there were ever a spill, a leak in the pipe, it could really cause a problem for our environment in Maine. So that's an immediate concern. And then the big concern is that my daughter, who's 5 and a half, needs to have a future. And we won't have a future on this planet if we burn all the tar sands that are in Alberta.
There's a 62-year-old pipeline running from here to Montreal, where it connects to more pipelines across Quebec and Ontario.
Dylan Voorhees works with the Natural Resources Council of Maine.
Right now, it carries regular crude oil north and west, but Alberta is sitting on a mountain of tar sands buried under the forests and the soils, and they're digging it out, and they're putting it in dump trucks the size of your house. The big oil companies want to get that tar sands out of Alberta to global energy markets, and that means getting it onto tankers. And the only thing standing in their way is us. A lot of states, a lot of provinces, they're trying to get it down Keystone to the Gulf. They're trying to get it across British Columbia to the Pacific. And they want to try and send it through this pipeline and reverse the flow down to Portland. The pipeline company is still saying they don't have an active plan to send tar sands through Maine. Just like I don't have an active plan for dinner yet tonight.
Emily Figdor is Executive Director of Environment Maine.
The presidential permit allows them to transport oil across the international border. But it says nothing, nothing about tar sands oil. And that gives President Obama and his State Department, which is soon to be run by Senator John Kerry.
Yeah, Kerry! Mark Powell!
It gives the president and John Kerry the chance to require a new permit and a new environmental review. We all heard President Obama talk about climate change in his inaugural address. He spent more time on it than any other issue. He declared that a failure to act would betray our children and future generations. This pipeline project, the tar sands fight, more broadly, keeping tar sands in the ground, that's at the core of the climate fight. But the only way that President Obama can stick his neck out on this issue and require a new permit and a new process is if we all give him reason to do so, that we speak out so loudly that he responds.
Portland area Congresswoman Shelley Pingree made a vow to locals and out-of-staters at the rally.
Damaging storms like Katrina and Hurricane Sandy, and right here in Maine when the lobsters shed 6 weeks earlier than normal, tells us the ocean is warming too fast, something that's going to cost us lives and jobs and our economic future and possibly the future of this earth. We have a lot of work ahead of us to develop renewable energy. We have a lot of work to do to make sure we end our dependence on carbon fuels and offshore oil, reversing the flow of the Portland pipeline so tar sands oil can be delivered to Portland Harbor would pose serious environmental risks. And I, on behalf of my constituents in Maine, am going to ask the Obama administration to do a full environmental review of any attempts to pump tar sands to that old pipeline.
Jason Brown, a member of the Penobscot Tribe of Maine, brought participants into a circle dance to end the rally, signifying, he said, that caring for the earth is everyone's responsibility. For Between the Lines, I'm Melinda Tuhus in Portland, Maine.
That was Between the Lines' Melinda Tuhus, reporting from Portland, Maine, on the January 26th protest against plans to bring tar sands oil from Canada through New England for export from Portland Harbor. Find more information on the campaigns to stop the development and transport of tar sands oil by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. Over the past several years of deep recession across Europe, the people of Greece have played the role of lab rat in the European Union's experiment with harsh austerity policies. The European Commission, the International Monetary Fund, and the European Central Bank, collectively known as the Troika, provided bailout funds to Greece, which was in danger of defaulting on its external debt, in exchange for mandating dramatic cuts in social spending, massive layoffs and pay freezes in the public sector, reduced pensions, and increased taxes. While advocates of austerity argued that the harsh measures were imposed to revive the Greek economy, instead Greece continues to experience its worst economic decline since World War II. The unemployment rate in Greece now stands at 26.8%, the highest in Europe, with an accompanying major drop in gross domestic product. Further, the average wage in Greece has fallen to 74% of the EU average, with a steep rise in poverty, homelessness, and a breakdown of the nation's social safety net. Reacting to the crippled economy, labor strikes and militant protests have become the norm across Greece, causing many citizens to lose faith in their political system. In the midst of the economic and political chaos, Syriza, the coalition of the radical left, Greece's main opposition party, is now leading in public opinion polls and could be well placed to win power in the next election. Alexis Tsipras, leader of the Syriza parliamentary group, recently visited the U.S., where he spoke at a number of venues, including the City University of New York. Here we present an excerpt of his January 25th talk on anti-austerity politics in Greece, Europe, and beyond.
I'm coming from the country which has chosen as the guinea pig, the testing tube, in the so-called attempt of the European Union leadership to resolve the economic crisis. Greece is experiencing these past years the biggest humanitarian crisis that any country has ever experienced under peace conditions. In my country, the people of lower incomes that have not created the crisis are paying for it. Workers are losing their jobs and their income is being dramatically decreased. Young people of an educated and skilled generation are migrating. Pensioners are watching their standards of living going back to that they had when they were young children. 2.5 years of the implementation of the memorandum have rendered Greece into a desert country. We are already on the 5th year of recession for the Greek economy. This is an unprecedented economic and social tragedy in Europe, and I believe that this is an unprecedented economic and social tragedy in whole Europe post-war history. The GDP fell by 25%. The poverty level climbed from 23% of the population in 2008 to 30% in 2012. At the same time, the new liberals say that the crisis is a big opportunity. But the question is, opportunity for whom? The answer is a big opportunity for the rich to become even richer, a big opportunity to eliminate labor rights conquered a century ago, a big opportunity for private capital, local as well as global, a big opportunity for private capital to obtain the public wealth and the public space. So, the conservative circle says that we are dangerous because we are stating the obvious, because we say that the memorandum, recession and austerity, is opposed to the laws of economics, is opposed to the laws of humanism. Syriza's radical left politics is not about getting Greece out of the Eurozone, and they know that well. But they say that we are dangerous. Yes, we are dangerous for this strategy. Our radical left label signifies that we are ready to radically reform the state in order to create a stable environment of justice, redistribution of wealth, and investment. It signifies that we will demand a new deal for Europe that mobilizes our contingents, productive capacities against want, against poverty, and against hopelessness. It signifies that the neoliberal memorandum is finished, that the neoliberal memorandum is dead, and it's time for Greek, European, and global reconstruction plan that puts people over profits. We were initially used as the guinea pig. We now stand as an example, as a paradigm. People in Spain, in Italy, Portugal, look upon Greece and see pictures of their own future. That is why, if things change in Greece, the whole European picture will change. Austerity, if you have a political change in Greece, austerity will be questioned in the heart of Europe and in whole Europe. And the need for the new fundamentals of the European Union will be hard to deny. Dear friends, thank you that you tried to understand what I said. And I hope that we have a common interests. So if we have common interests, we have a common language. Thank you very much.
That was Alexis Tsipras, leader of Syriza, the coalition of the radical left, Greece's main opposition party. This segment was recorded at the City University of New York on January 25th. For more analysis on Greece and the European economic crisis, visit our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, the weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines through our website at btlonline.org, where you can hear our current and archive programs in MP3 and streaming audio. There you can also subscribe to free weekly podcasts, program summaries, and interview transcripts. Follow us on Facebook at Between the Lines Radio News Magazine and on Twitter at BTL Radio News. Our theme music was written by Richard Hill and Jody Gray and performed by Mikata. This week's program was produced by Liz Becker, Richard Hill, Hank Hoffman, Anna Manzo, Bob Nixon, Gary Trujillo, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Scott Harris.